Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a fundamental truth of the financial world that there is no investment safer than the U.S. government. That's why Treasury bonds have AAA credit ratings. It's been that way forever. One recession, a financial crisis, and $1.5 trillion in federal deficits later, seems Uncle Sam might be due for a downgrade. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, www.batteninstitute.org. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you with us on this Thursday, everybody. It is the 22nd of October today. The credit markets are all about ratings. You get good ones like AAA, the very best. You pay less to borrow money. That is true for companies, and it's true for governments. So this morning, when an analyst from Moody's said he's been taking a long, hard look at the federal deficit and that America's AAA rating is not a sure thing, well, it was most unwelcome news. Paying more to borrow the trillions that the Treasury Department needs to finance the stimulus bill and the bailouts is not a happy prospect for Washington or for individual investors. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
Uncle Sam has always been considered the world's safest borrower. Rating agencies figure he's good for his debts, but the White House is forecasting $1 trillion-plus deficits through 2011. And David Jones, a former Fed official and now with DMJ Advisors, says the U.S. should heed today's warning from Moody's.
There will be a moment, we can't define it perfectly, when the world says we don't want to see any more of that debt. Interest rates will shoot up and the dollar will collapse. So we have a moment of truth coming here.
Individual investors who sought shelter from the financial headwinds by putting their money into AAA Treasury bonds might be dismayed. But David Kotok says it's highly unlikely the Treasury will default on its bonds, since it can just ask the Federal Reserve to print money. Kotok is the chief investment officer at Cumberland Advisors in New Jersey. He says there are alternatives for risk-averse investors, like bonds backed by state and local governments.
And a good example of an issuer that is very safe is the New Jersey Turnpike. They issued taxable municipal securities to fund some of their activity, and those bonds pay a higher interest rate than the corresponding Treasury bonds.
Kotok figures the revenue for those bonds is pretty secure, since there's no other choice for people who drive between New York and Delaware. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
White House Pazar Kenneth Feinberg made his bailout salary cuts official today on average reductions of about 50% for the top earners at the seven companies that got the most public money. Thing is, the people who brought in a lot of the money that Wall Street firms made over the past couple of years were farther down the ladder, folks who were promised big bonuses to trade or to sell or to broker pretty much anything they could. So we asked Ashley Melton-Tite to find out whether today's news will do much to discourage the behavior that landed us in this mess to begin with.
Not really. Naomi Prince is a former Goldman Sachs executive. She's written a book about the financial crisis called It Takes a Pillage. She says these cuts won't reduce risks to the financial system, and they focus on too small a group of companies.
It gives a free pass to the others that are by nature increasing the risk in the financial system because of the profits that are coming directly from their trading arms and because of the bonuses that are yet again being paid from those profits.
She says banks like Goldman Sachs are making huge profits from trading, and their pay structures still encourage risk-taking. Karen Ho is an anthropology professor at the University of Minnesota. She studied the culture of Wall Street. She says the government's move is largely symbolic.
I don't think that it is strong enough to influence Wall Street bonus culture, which is embedded in the very fabric of their cultural identity. And their incentive structure is tied to how they understand themselves, they understand talent.
She says it's not tied to whether a trade is successful in the long run. Eric Moskowitz says that should change. He's head of compensation consulting for Options Group in New York. He'd like to see the government insisting on clawback provisions.
When these risks are taken and the money is lost in year two and year three, the banks need to be understanding that that money needs to come back to that investor or needs to come back to that shareholder as appropriate.
He says so far the government's left it up to individual banks to put those clawbacks in place. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Today, the Federal Communications Commission voted to stop internet service providers, that's companies like Verizon and AT&T, from picking favorites on the web. The buzzword you're looking for here is net neutrality, as Marketplace's Steve Henn explains.
Last year, Comcast slowed down some types of streaming video files traveling on its network. That made it tough for customers to watch things like PBS and Showtime online.
What was troubling for consumers was some of that programming competed with Comcast's own cable programming.
Markham Erickson runs the Open Internet Coalition. He represents firms like Skype and Google that favor the FCC's new proposed rules. They'd force internet service providers to treat all web traffic equally. Without these rules, Erickson worries telecoms could restrict consumer choices.
What the cable and telephone companies are interested in is turning the internet into something that's more akin to cable television.
Erickson argues right now there's little to stop AT&T from slowing down web traffic to a competitor like Skype, the online phone service. Nothing prevents Comcast or Time Warner from crushing video streaming companies like Hulu. But John Banks at U.S. Telecom begs to differ.
AT&T, Verizon, whoever you want to name, isn't doing it now. And the reason they're not doing it now is, in my view, because consumers don't want that. Consumers want to be able to go places and use new applications.
Banks says telecoms need to be allowed to manage networks, and this has nothing to do with playing favorites.
Internet traffic growth is exploding, and it has been for years.
Banks says telecoms need to direct traffic, or there could be tie-ups. He's worried the proposed rules could get in the way. The FCC's final rules are expected this summer. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Nothing neutral about the major indices on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. In their out-of-nowhere bestseller a couple of years ago called Freakonomics, journalist Stephen Dubner and University of Chicago economist Stephen Levitt explored economics and human behavior, how what you think is going to happen when people have certain incentives often doesn't. They are back this week with the sequel, Super Freakonomics, it's called, in which they apply that law of unintended consequences to prostitutes and suicide bombers, and most controversially, perhaps, to global warming, whether trying to cut down on carbon is the right thing to do or whether there is a cheaper, more technological fix. That part is at the end of this interview you're about to hear. To get things started, I asked Stephen Dubner how the pair sorts out all the data that they dig up.
The thing that got me interested in economics was about 8 or 10 years ago, and that was behavioral economics. So that is some of the stuff that we've talked about, which are often very small, really, really interesting lab experiments that produce a really interesting story that makes you say, holy cow, people aren't as rational as economists have been saying. And what we try to do are cool, slightly bigger stories, which is to say, instead of depending on little studies in the lab that represent the artificiality of the lab, we try instead to go out into the real world and find real data that reflects real human behavior and then try to make sense of it.
Well, tell me one of those cool little stories then.
Here's one that's, I don't know if it's cool or not.
It's got to be cool because Dubner said it's
going
to
be
a cool story.
Okay, I'll give you a cool one then instead. So in the lab, there's a game called the Dictator Game. Mm-hmm. And the Dictator Game involves two people, and you just give $10, say, to one of the college students, and they can either keep the money themselves or they can hand it over to as much as they want a gift to the other person. And what happens in the lab is that, in general, these college students tend to give about $3 or $4 away to the person on the other side of the wall, even though they'll never see them again. They don't even know who they're giving the money to. And economists have interpreted this as evidence that people are altruistic. Now, if you go out into the field, say, and you walk, you go on the subway, you can stand around all day and no stranger is going to come by and open up their wallet and say, hey, I've got 10 bucks in my wallet. I'm going to give you three. So it's something you don't even need to run the experiment in the field. You know that people just aren't as altruistic as they look in the lab.
But I think in the real world, what's just so interesting, I mean, this is what makes it fun for us, or I'll speak at least for me, fun for me is It's neat to see the way that human behavior is often unpredictable, even by the smartest people who use really seemingly clever incentives. I read something the other day about a very well-regarded paleontologist who found this nice location where there are a lot of human remains. Actually, I don't remember if there were human remains or animal remains. There were bones, and he hired a bunch of the natives to help him dig the bones. It was really hard work, and he promised them, this was a long time ago, he promised them 10 cents per bone fragment. So what he discovered was that when they would find a big fragment, they'd crush it to pieces to get more money. Not very good for paleontology, unfortunately.
So this is human beings messing up a perfectly good experiment, right?
Exactly right, yes. We always get in our own way.
We get now to Chapter 5, the one on global warming. And I want to spend a little bit of time here because you guys have gotten a lot of criticism for some of the things you say here. Maybe the most significant part of it is that you are alleged to have misrepresented the views of Ken Caldera, a climate scientist, and that you did it in order to make this book more controversial. What do you say to that?
This fellow, Ken Caldera, who's a very well-regarded climate scientist, he was asked if we had represented his views properly. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of back and forth. And the ultimate conclusion from this climate blogger who had asked him this was that no, it was deeply misrepresented. And I just have to tell you, as a journalist who takes this stuff pretty seriously, it's a little bit offensive because it's untrue. And so the trail of proof here is the fact that, you know, not only did we write this chapter in a judicious and considered way, but incorporated the feedback from this scientist and others.
Let me say, not just feedback. I mean, he's read the chapter.
He also says that the way you guys framed his remarks leaves a misimpression. And that's a fairly serious discussion in a book that is, on the day it's out, number 8 on the Amazon list.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of misimpression. Ken Caldera is a climate scientist who's worth listening to. The reason we listen to him and the reason he's in this chapter at all is because he is with a group of guys who are proposing a different kind of solution than just carbon mitigation. And so that in and of itself is a controversial topic. There are people who probably wish that a climate scientist like Ken Caldera would never go near anybody who's even thinking about geoengineering.
Is it possible to have this kind of debate, the serious policy-oriented debate on issues that touch on economics and climate and environment and all these kinds of things, without it getting ideological or political, though?
I would say no at this point. I think that there is as much politics in climate science as there is science. If you read our chapter, what we're saying is global warming is potentially a very important problem. And the approach that most people seem to think is the right one is to lower carbon emissions. The problem with that approach is, number one, it's very expensive. Number two, takes a long time. All we're saying is, look, if you really think this is a catastrophe in the making, why have we taken off the table the kinds of solutions like geoengineering, which can give us immediate and cheap potential solution to the problem?
Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt are the authors first of Freakonomics, but also now Super Freakonomics, Global Cooling, Patriotic Prostitutes, and Why Suicide Bombers Should Buy Life Insurance. Guys, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
It's been a pleasure.
And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials bounced back 1.3% today, 131 points, closed at 10,081. The NASDAQ pulled forward 0.2%, 14 points, finished at 2165. The S&P 500 put on 1%, that's 11 points, closed at 1,092. Financial firms led the ascent after the Travelers raised its outlook for the year. The insurance company put on more than 7.3%. Wells Fargo ticked up more than 4%. Morgan Stanley pulled in close to 5%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 2.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.42%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Obama talks about clean energy during a visit to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for the month of September. And the singer and satirist, famous for his parodies, celebrates his birthday. Weird Al Yankovic turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We learned this morning Kentucky Fried Chicken is going to try another giveaway with the hopes that it goes better than the one they did back in May. They partnered with Oprah Winfrey for that one, putting coupons for free grilled chicken dinners on her website. Oprah being, well, Oprah, KFC was promptly overloaded with people wanting their freebies. So overloaded, in fact, that a lot of restaurants ran out of food. Among the faithful back then was our very own senior editor, Patty Hirsch, who I've got in the studio with me now to ask this very simple question, Mr. Hirsch. With whatever it is that you make an hour, is waiting in line for a $5 freebie really the best use of your time?
As you know, I work very hard. So when I go home, I don't want to be slaving over a hot stove. So yes. I eat out quite a lot. So when anyone sends me a link that's going to give me a coupon for a free meal, I'm going
to
take it.
What we're trying to get at here is this idea of opportunity cost. I mean, you know, $5 freebie, waiting in line for what, 40 minutes, an hour?
Well, it could have been, because when I got to the parking lot, which was, by the way, was stuffed full of Mercedes and Lexuses and BMWs, there was a line kind of around the block there. So, and a lot of these ladies, and they were all ladies, by the way, didn't know what was going on. So I sort of elbowed my way to the front of the queue.
Nice.
I wanted to find out what was happening. I didn't want to leave them in the dark. And I found out that they'd actually run out of the amount of free chicken that they could have given out. They did actually have some more chicken in there, so I could have bought some for however many, $5. But I, of course, declined because I'm pretty cheap, too.
Of course you did. But does this change it at all for you? If it's not a whole dinner like it was last time, it's just a piece of chicken.
It's free, Kai. That's the point. I mean, they could be giving away, you know, Diet Pepsi, which I don't drink. But the fact that it's free is enough for me to get in line. To me, it's worth it. Free is good.
I should probably point out here that you are a freebie hound. You're the guy who ran over to Starbucks that morning that they were giving away free instant coffee, too.
To me, Kai, free just tastes better. I mean, you may have to expend a little bit of time, but the kind of rush that you get from getting something for free, I think it's worth that time.
Patty Hirsch, our senior editor here at Marketplace. You have seen him, I'm sure, on our website doing his whiteboard videos. Maybe, Patty, I don't know, something on opportunity cost here in the future?
We could do. I'll have to talk to my agent about negotiation, but yeah,
won't
no reason
be free
why not.
Then, right?
Absolutely.
Patty Hirsch, thanks.
Thank you.
Last year at this time was interesting. We were just a couple of weeks away from a presidential election. We were still adjusting to the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the true effects of the financial crisis. But a lot of people were already living it, including two that we profiled on this program. Brian Tackett had just lost his job at a New York insurance broker.
I would say 100% I am a direct casualty of, you know, what's going on in the financial markets right now.
Christopher Maraldi was laid off by Wachovia just a couple of months before the market crashed, which means he lost his health care.
At precisely the moment when you do get downsized, all of a sudden your health care costs jump through the roof with COBRA.
Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson caught up with both of them a couple of weeks ago.
A year ago, I met with Brian Tackett near his old office in Lower Manhattan. We sat with lunching Wall Streeters in nearby Battery Park, staring out at the Statue of Liberty. But this year, Brian Tackett has moved to where the jobs are, and we find ourselves in Lafayette Park, right across Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House. What happened?
Well, the job market in New York, being as it was, no prospects after 3 months. So I decided to come down here and give D.C. a shot.
So you came down here without a job?
Yeah, no job whatsoever. Just hooked up with a couple of my friends, stayed with them. They were.
And after 5 months, with less than $500 in his bank account, he found a job at a risk management firm that paid far less than he made in New York. But when I called his office to set up this interview a couple of weeks ago, I was told he no longer worked for the company. What happened with this job?
Kind of a difference in opinion, I think, on some things that I felt that we needed to do. So I decided to part ways.
You decided to do it?
Yeah, I decided to do that myself.
I mean, in this market?
I think it is a completely different job market here in Washington. I think that there is a very flourishing, burgeoning government.
Would you have done this a year ago?
Absolutely not. I wouldn't have done it a year ago even in Washington, and I would not have done it a year ago certainly in New York.
And you may be surprised to hear that after the rough year 29-year-old Brian Tackett has had, he calls the whole thing a 100% positive experience.
You know, in the long haul, I'm going to look back on this last year and say nothing but good things. And, you know, certainly with kids one day, we'll say, back when I was almost 30, this happened, and these are the things that I learned. So if I can do that, you can survive anything, I promise.
On the day I met Christopher Maraldi, he was turning 47. We met on the exact same bench in New York Central Park that we'd sat on a year ago, and he is still unemployed.
I mean, I've been looking for work all along, but I've been looking at different options besides just financial services. Financial services had, I mean, almost a complete blackout for 5 full months.
Maraldi waited out the worst of the crisis teaching English in Ukraine. Now he's applied to the Peace Corps and the Foreign Service. But the problem he mentioned to me last year has only gotten worse.
The problem now is health insurance. And this was unexpected. Everyone said that COBRA was expensive, but I thought it was reasonable. I was paying $440 a month. Well, when COBRA ended and I had Aetna, it jumped to $932 a month.
If you're unfamiliar with COBRA, it only allows you to extend your previous employer's health benefits for 18 months. And Maraldi has now been out of work for 20.
This was a learning process. It was interesting given all the talk about healthcare right now. So,
yeah, a year ago you were living the banking nightmare and now you're in the healthcare situation.
I know. It's sad, isn't it?
Maraldi says he'll never feel totally secure in a job again. After all, he spent years at Wachovia, only to be laid off in a round of cuts. But as for the last year, like Brian Tackett, he has no regrets.
My father died at age 54, 1 year before he was supposed to retire. And he wanted to travel. He was looking so forward to retiring. And I feel that I've had a little sneak preview, and it's been an absolute wonderful experience. And, you know, if you do get let go, you know, ask yourself, was this really the right job for me anyway? Maybe there was something else that I would have rather done.
And save enough money so that you can do it.
Save, save, save. I have always been a saver, and I still will now.
If only people had thought like that on and off Wall Street while they still had their jobs. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
If you don't have a daughter, a young daughter, you may never have heard of the American Girl dolls. If you do have a little girl, then you may know more about those dolls than you care to. All of them come with books that tell their life stories, and they're full of triumph over evil, like Mean Girls at School and Can-Do Spirit. But not too long ago, the company, owned by Mattel, came out with a new blonde-haired doll with a hard luck story we haven't heard from American Girl before. And Sally Herships reports from New York she has raised quite a ruckus.
Barbie has her dream house, and Disney princesses have their castles. But Gwen, a new doll from the American Girl company, is homeless, at least for a little while. And she's been causing an uproar with a lot of help from the media.
In the Breakfast Buzz this morning, she is no Barbie, that's for sure.
She is homeless, apparently, and lives in a car.
I think that if you're going to raise awareness of homelessness with your kids, if that's the goal, maybe you could just give money to your local homeless shelter.
No one from American Girl would go on tape. But the company says people are overreacting, that homelessness is an issue a lot of kids are facing right now. And the company hopes Gwen's story will raise awareness. Every American Girl doll comes with a book. Gwen is a minor character in another doll's story, and American Girl says you don't even learn she's homeless until close to the end of the book. Mary Brosnahan is executive director of New York City's Coalition for the Homeless.
I don't think it's that bad. I don't think it's something for people to get that twisted about.
Brosnahan points out that homelessness is on the rise. More than 1.3 million children don't have a home. So, she says, Gwen is a good way for kids to learn about the problem. Kids with a roof of their own, the ones who are more likely to have a $95 American Girl doll.
I don't like that everything's become so commercialized, but if there is some way for a child to identify with another homeless child, more power to them.
But will shoppers agree? American Girl wouldn't discuss sales, so I headed to Manhattan's enormous American Girl store to find out.
Can I have both of these someday for Biddy?
Maybe someday.
Do you know what it means to be homeless?
Yes.
How would it make you feel if you had a doll that didn't have a home?
I guess kind of sad.
Do you think it would be okay to sell a doll like that?
Yes, because there's nothing really wrong with that.
Most parents agreed they're fine with a homeless doll, but the $95 price tag, not so much.
$95 is a lot of money for a doll. Even a Disney doll. Even Cinderella.
Some other parents were concerned that Gwen's story might be too upsetting for young girls, but not Deirdre, who lives with her 7-year-old daughter Keely in a New York City homeless shelter.
If you're homeless, you're homeless. You can be homeless from 2 to 100. I mean, if that's your situation, that's your situation.
I asked Deirdre and Keely what they think about a homeless doll.
I think it's okay. It's not a problem because it basically portrays what's really going on out here. It's just basically putting it up front and center, letting you know that these things do happen.
What do you think? Do you think you would like to have a doll like that?
Yes.
Why?
I don't know.
If you got a doll, what do you think would be important about the doll?
That it get to dress her up.
Some things about little girls and dolls are universal, no matter where you live. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the Kirby bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, federal officials announced this afternoon they are looking into an incident in which a Northwest Airlines jet flew 150 miles past its intended destination last night. The National Transportation Safety Board says the San Diego to Minneapolis flight lost radio contact with air traffic controllers for a little more than an hour. The plane did land fine. Everybody was safe, if a little bit late. The NTSB is looking into whether pilot fatigue played a role. But here's the best part. According to the FAA, the crew explained they lost track of where they were because they were having a heated discussion about aviation policy. And that is Marketplace. On that note, from American Public Media, today the Dow packed on 131 points, 1.33%. The NASDAQ rose 14 points, 2/3%. The S&P 500 gained 11 points, that is 1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the broadcast, slowing the climate change freefall.
We've got to do everything we can as fast as we can. There are, unfortunately, no silver bullets, no technology that replaces fossil fuel one for one. It was good stuff. It's too bad it's wrecking the planet.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.